Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, a LGBTQ plus studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. Today I'll be talking to Josephine Donovan about her book, The Lexington Six, Lesbian and Gay Resistance in 1970s America, published by University of Massachusetts Press. On September 23, 1970, a group of anti-war activists staged a robbery at a bank in Massachusetts, during which a police officer was killed. While the three men who participated in the robbery were soon apprehended, two women escaped and became fugitives on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, eventually landing in a lesbian collective in Lexington, Kentucky, during the summer of 1974. In pursuit, the FBI launched a massive dragnet. Five lesbian women and one gay man ended up in jail for refusing to cooperate with federal officials, whom they saw as invading their lives and community. Dubbed the Lexington Six, the group's resistance attracted national attention, inspiring a nationwide movement in other minority communities. Like the iconic Stonewall demonstrations, this gripping story of spirited defiance has special resonance in today's America. Drawing on transcripts of the judicial hearings, contemporaneous newspaper accounts, hundreds of pages of FBI files released to the author under the Freedom of Information Act, in interviews with many of the participants, Josephine Donovan reconstructs this fascinating untold story. The Lexington Six is a vital addition to the LGBTQ feminist and radical American history. Josephine, welcome to our podcast. So excited to have you here today. I wondered if you could begin by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, in connection with this book, I was an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky at the time of the events of the Lexington Six. I knew some of the participants, and I was somewhat aware of what was happening at the time. This was in January and February of 1975, and I attended the contempt hearings for the Lexington Six, in which they were held in contempt and sent to Kentucky County jails. And I saw them carted off to the jails in chains, by the way. They put them in chains. So I was familiar, and I visited the jails later when they were incarcerated. So I was familiar with the events of the case, and for many years I wanted to write a book about it, but it was only recently that some important oral histories that had been done shortly after the events of the case became available to researchers. And when I learned that, I thought, well, maybe I can actually write this book and track down some of the other sources that will fill in the whole story, and I can put it all together. And so so I began working on it a few years ago. And that's basically my connection to the case. As I say, I was on the faculty at the University of Kentucky at the time, and have written a number of books in the area of literary criticism and feminist theory, animal ethics, eventually ended up at the University of Maine, where I'm an emerita professor at the present time.
You talk a little bit about your own experience during these times, and there's so many questions I have for you, it's hard to even know where to jump in. But I guess I'll start with, if you could describe to listeners what Lexington, Kentucky was like in the 1970s, especially the feminist movement. And you talk, I remember reading in your book about the town and gown division that you, that people experienced in Lexington at that time, especially.
Well, of course, this was still during the period of the Vietnam War. And the Lexington campus of the University of Kentucky had a strong anti-war movement going on for several years, really. And there was quite a bit of antagonism between the, mainstream people of Kentucky and the university students. So there, that was kind of a backdrop for the town gown problem in Lexington at the time. And of course, it was the era of the counterculture, and students were into drugs and, you know, had long shaggy hair and wore kind of ragged clothes. And I mean, all of this aggravated the straight mainstream people. And so if you throw in then the issue of lesbian and gay identities, you can understand that there was a significant divide between the two groups. And of course, the grand jurors were members of the mainstream community. And so that was part of the problem, I think, in the confrontation between the Lexington Six and the grand jury. But even more acute, I think, was the situation of lesbians and gays in Kentucky and indeed in the country at the time. I mean, it was not a chic thing to be. And to be outed at that time meant you could be imprisoned, you could lose your job, you could have your parents turn against you, you could have friends turn against you. It was a matter of being shamed publicly, and it was a terrible ordeal to be outed. And of course, these Lexington Six were all being outed by the publicity, and of course by the FBI, who were informing parents and employers and friends and so forth. So that was part of the atmosphere at the time. That's important to understand. But there was also, of course, the rising second wave women's movement. And I think that inspired a number of the Lexington Six, all of them really, to carry on their resistance to the intrusive tactics of the FBI. And so it's important to understand the strength, really, of the women's movement at the time. And, of course, the gay and lesbian movement was just beginning, too. And so that was also a factor, especially for the gay man in the group.
In the group, yeah. You talk about in the book second wave feminist theory. And I wondered if you could explain to listeners what that is, for listeners who aren't familiar with feminist theory.
Well, it was the basic concepts of feminism today were rooted in second wave feminism, which kind of emerged in the late 1960s as a result of the shabby treatment that women were receiving in some of the political movements of the day, the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. And so the women decided to have a movement of their own, the Women's Liberation Movement, and to assert the rights of women to, to have full existence in the world, and not be treated as second-class citizens forever. So that was the, and there are some very basic principles. The main one being that the women's liberation of women is the root liberation for any revolutionary movements, and also the various concepts that we consider mainstream today, like the personal is political and things like that, were developed, and of course, concern about domestic violence and rape and most of the issues that are of concern today were first addressed by the second wave of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s.
And you talk about in the book how there are different ways that the Lexington Six were influenced, or different reasons why they chose to resist the FBI. And I guess one of them was second wave feminists. They're just their beliefs in feminist theory.
Well, I think they felt that their community was being attacked by the FBI, which of course were all white males, and they were behaving very aggressively and intrusively, banging on the people's doors, barging into their apartments, and threatening them and blackmailing them and bullying them. And so it just became a matter of personal resistance to these macho offensive behaviors on the part of the FBI agents. So that was part of it. Part of it was loyalty to the two fugitives that they had known. They didn't know about their past at the time when they were living in Lexington, and they didn't know about their violent actions in the Boston bank robbery. They knew them under disguise and also under using false names. But they felt loyalty to them as friends and as feminists, as lesbians. And so there was a sense of sisterhood or of personal loyalty, of political solidarity that I think motivated them. Certainly at the beginning, that was the, I think, the primary motivation, and that sense of resistance against attacks against their lesbian feminist community.
Sure, sure. And it's from what you say in the book, the FBI was going beyond just asking questions about who knew these fugitives, but or these two women who had been involved in the bank robbery, but they were also asking personal questions and seems like trying to dig into who was in the community and what was going on.
Well, then they began asking personal questions like who was involved with whom and who was a lesbian, who wasn't, who knew whom and what their political beliefs were. And the FBI seemed to have developed this theory that nationally there was this network of violent lesbians that were harboring all these fugitives, and so they were really focused on the lesbian and gay community nationally, really, and so that was part of the theory that they were going on. Of course, it was false. There was no such network, but that was part of the reason they kept going after lesbians. And to some extent, gay men, too. And, of course, I think they sensed that this was a vulnerable community that they could go after without having any kind of public outcry. And of course, they were right in that.
Yeah, I remember there was a point in your book when you talk about how easy it is for a powerful force like the government, the FBI, going after a community that is not well respected or not approved of in society.
Yes, I think so. They, I think they felt they had a certain license to go after minority groups because, the mainstream white audience would not be as concerned about them. And so they targeted Native Americans, African Americans, Chicano, the Chicano movement, the Puerto Rican American movement. There were just numbers of minority groups that they used these same tactics after, really, the Lexington 6 case, which served as a kind of a model of resistance for many of these groups, I think. And so as the resistance movement grew, many of these groups were also into finding themselves held in contempt and thrown into jail in the same way that the Lexington Six were.
Yeah. It almost seemed humorous to me, in a strange way, I guess, that I think the quote you used, the quote I'm taking from your book, is you said the FBI believed there was this, quote, secret lesbian cabal that were harboring fugitives such as Patty Hearst.
Yes. And that was their erroneous theory, but there may have been a lot of unconscious motivations of, in fact, I'm sure there were, of being threatened by these defiant women, and especially in the case of the judge and the prosecuting attorney, I think they developed a sense of that these uppity women need to be put back in their place, and the sense that that this is not proper behavior for young women, and that they need to be taught a lesson. I'm sure that this became a kind of motivation for the judge, especially. He was outraged at the fact that they were refusing to cooperate, and in a very defiant way. If you read the transcripts, they really they weren't shy about expressing their contempt, really, for the whole process. And that offended the judge, and it added to the whole emotional confrontation in the case, which maybe in the end was probably why Jill Raymond, for example, ended up spending over a year in a Kentucky County jail, just because the judge was irritated at her, basically.
Well, and I think you said that one of the lawyers, who was a woman, the judge was offended by the fact that she wore a pantsuit.
That's right.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
And actually ordered her to change clothes. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
I mean, in general, of course, this was just the beginning of the women's movement, and so these people like the judge, who was an older white man, were just kind of perplexed and uncertain how to handle these assertive women. And so proper women wore dresses. And so she was, she wasn't being proper. And of course, she was a very assertive and defiant attorney. And that also, I think, was clearly he was upset about that. And so that kind of dynamic was going on as well.
Yeah, I remember there's a part you include a transcript in, I remember reading up one of the transcripts where he is really disrespectful to her
She
tries to make a case. But I think you said it sounded like he was a little bit intimidated by her also.
Well, I think he was flummoxed by her. I mean, it's true at this point. And women, had not behaved like this, or at least that was the going assumption. I think that probably is false too. But the norm, at any rate, was for women to be polite, and quiet and submissive. And she was not, and neither were any of the Lexington Six women. And
right.
So. So they were defying norms, which added to the whole drama of the case, and maybe in the end became the underlying issue.
Of course, you say in the book that you were away, I believe you said Massachusetts, maybe, when the two women who were the fugitives were living in Lexington, but you came back later as a lot of this is blowing up and the FBI is interviewing people, I guess.
Yes, I was on leave in the fall of 1974, which is when the two fugitives were, well, the summer and fall of 74 were living in Lexington. I came back in January and for the spring semester at the university to teach. And by that time, the FBI arrived on the scene in the first week in January. So I knew some of these people that were being interrogated, and so I was aware of the process going on at the time. In fact, I was somewhat concerned that I might be interrogated at that time, which I was not, but I was later, a couple of years later. But after that was after the Lexington Six. They renewed the search for Kathy Power in 1978, and interviewed a lot of people. At that time, I was living in just north of Boston, and so there was a huge dragnet in the Boston area at that time, and I had an FBI agent come to the door at that point and ask me if I knew where Kathy Power was, and I said I had nothing to say.
Which, that must have been terribly frightening. It's hard to even imagine.
What was that?
I said it must have been terribly frightening to have an FBI agent come to your door.
Because I knew what happens when you don't cooperate, and I'd been prompted by being aware of the case that you should say to the FBI, "I have nothing to say," and that sort of cuts off the discussion. So that's what I told them, and happily for me, I didn't hear from them again, although I lived in dread of it for months, really. But by then the case was pretty cold, and they never did catch Kathy Power, by the way. I mean, she eventually turned herself in 20-some years later, but they never caught her.
It's amazing. Wow. And I can't imagine the psychological effect this has on people. And you even mentioned, I think it must be at the end of the book, that you even had your mail gone through at times. You discovered your mail was being opened.
It definitely was, yes. Even the mail delivery person down in Lexington, he said, "I don't know what you're up to, but nobody has the right to open your mail." So it was pretty obvious it was ripped open and then taped back. I was a fringe person. I mean, I had nothing to do with the case, really, but I just happened to be a feminist living in Lexington, basically. But the main figures were, not only was their mail being opened, but their phones, of course, were wiretapped. That was pretty clear. Their garbage was being, rifled through by FBI agents, and they were being trailed. They were being tracked, by agents, 6 feet behind, so to speak, as Carrie Junkin put it. So there was a sense of surveillance, and it was very frightening. That was frightening in and of itself. I mean, I didn't feel that personally. Again, I wasn't really that directly involved, but for the principals, their whole lives were just completely overturned by this siege, really, of the these agents that were onto them constantly for weeks until they finally were subpoenaed before the grand jury, and even after they were released, they still had problems with the FBI, in some cases for years. So it was, their whole lives were just completely turned over, and they were completely innocent. It was like, it's really unbelievable, and it still is, but at the time, everybody was just bewildered at how could this be happening.
Yeah, I remember you said that it was pretty clear that the FBI knew that they didn't have any information to share, but yet they were forcing them to talk about these personal details of their lives.
Right. Well, that's where you begin to wonder, why did they keep pursuing this? I mean, that there was some other motivation there than just tracking these fugitives. And that's why I say I think they were kind of out to get they just didn't approve of the lesbian and gay existence. And so there was a punitive element, I think, involved that has nothing to do with what the proper purpose of the FBI is, which is to track fugitives and bring them to justice. So yeah. it got way off track and it became almost a kind of a vendetta or persecution that had very little to do with proper FBI behavior. And by the way, of course, the FBI had a long history of being obsessed with lesbians and gays, going back to the era of J. Edgar Hoover.
Right, right.
Totally, totally obsessed with the issue. And during the 1950s, there was the so-called Lavender Scare, in which President Eisenhower issued a regulation that no gays or lesbians could serve in the federal government. And so so J. Edgar Hoover developed this so-called sex deviance file on which he had thousands of names. And there was this purge to find all these so-called perverts, which is the term that was used as pervert, in the federal government. And this continued into the 60s. And I think was still, even though Hoover had died by the time of the Lexington Six case, I think the obsession with gays and lesbians was still there in the sort of mentality of the FBI.
Well, and as you noted in your book, in Kentucky and many states, there was still the sodomy law,
right,
in effect.
Yeah, it wasn't until many years later that that was overturned, and then nationally, it wasn't until the 21st century, really, that the Supreme Court finally ruled to overturn all those laws.
The women in the Lexington Six, especially, must have, all of them must have had tremendous courage. And I know that you were on the periphery, and I think you knew a couple of the people in the Lexington Six. But I wondered if you could talk about just what they were like and the courage that it took for them to resist, like as they did.
Well, they certainly had a lot of courage and determination. And I think partly in the end, they were fired by this sense of indignation and outrage that they were being treated this way. And they just had this feeling that it was wrong to be treated so completely unjustly. And the longer it went on, the more their feeling of outrage grew, I think. And so the tone in some of their statements in the grand jury hearings was very defiant and kind of amazing how strong and defiant they really were. And after all, these were basically kids, I mean, 20, 21, and had no previous experience of this kind. They weren't lawyers, I mean, and yet they rose to the occasion in a way that is really, really remarkable. I don't know what gave them that kind of strength other than, as I say, their own personal outrage and then their sense of loyalty to friends and to the community that they felt was under siege. And the other thing about it is that it happened so quickly. They were living peaceful lives in December of 74, and by March they were in jail. And I think the fact that they were able to react so quickly and so strongly is in itself kind of an amazing accomplishment.
It really is.
Yeah, it is. And then, of course, for Jill Raymond, who managed to endure over a year in these really grim Kentucky County jails, that was a matter of real perseverance. And I think she would admit that she just played it day by day, that, you know, if she had known at the beginning that she had a whole year to spend, she probably would have given up at the beginning. But to play it day by day, she was able to make it through. And then she was reinforced, I think, by the support she was getting but from lots and lots of people. And it became a kind of national issue at a certain point, and so she felt strengthened by that. There's one can't overemphasize what kind of personal strength all of them showed, I think.
Because of the trauma, the psychological and physical trauma, this would impact on somebody.
And I mean, those Kentucky County jails were, as one person described them, were like medieval dungeons. I mean, they were nothing. They weren't modern. They were, you know, really grim. And these were, you know, middle-class kids that had not experienced any severe physical hardships to that point. And yet they accepted that they lived through it. I mean, they... most of them, a couple of them found it intolerable, but so anyway, they do stand as an example of remarkable courage and integrity.
What was it like for them in jail?
For them?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean.
What were the conditions like in the jail itself?
They were very small, cramped quarters. Each jail was different, but they were scattered about the state. There was the one over in Pineville was a very narrow, cramped quarters that, you know, did very much look like a medieval dungeon. I mean, it had a huge wooden door. I think it was wooden. I can't remember, but... anyway, and they lived there with sometimes as many as four people in the room. And the food was terrible, of course. It was just, you know, the same thing over and over and usually not very healthy.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then this was a time where there was no social media, there was no internet. So the only interaction would be someone who would come to visit you. And one of the jails, I think, had a TV set, but some of them didn't even have that. So they were, to the extent that they were, you know, alone, I mean, the solitariness of it in itself was, and just the griminess of it, I mean, the lack of cleanliness and so forth.
Just the simple fact of having your freedom taken away and with all those additional things.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the main thing, yes. That's a key point.
I wanted to ask you what it was like for you when you actually attended the final, I guess the court, when the court was in session, the judge made his final ruling, what it was like for you. And then you had that poignant scene where you go behind the court to see, I can't remember which of the women it was, but in the car, and she holds up her, you know, she holds up her wrist to show you she's going to.
Well, yeah. I was in the courtroom. I was at the back. It was a huge courtroom and it was packed with people. So I didn't actually see, I couldn't see too much of what was going on. So I can't say I have a rather fuzzy recollection of that whole part of it. But afterwards, I went around, I was trying to decide, I thought, well, they're going to have to take them off to these jails. So I went around behind the courthouse and there they were in the police vans. And so I went up to and there didn't seem to be anybody around. It was kind of a strange situation. Yeah. I just went up to one of the vans, and it happened to be Jill Raymond, and I said a few words to her, and she tried to raise her hand, but of course they were shackled together and in handcuffs and stuff. But she was, you know, and I wouldn't say high spirits, but cheerful, and kind of waved to me, and as they then they carted them off. It was
amazing.
Of course, it was a totally wrenching. I mean, to see your friends, you know, just hauled off like that. I mean, in a completely unjust and unfair example of tyranny, really. It was appalling, and of course it lived with me to this day, really.
Yeah, it would be like a nightmare seeing this unfold, especially for the people involved.
And feeling so helpless, you know, that there was nothing you could do about it. And all the efforts of, of course they were going to appeal, and there were a lot of legal efforts going on, but still the actual fact that was they were being herded off to these miserable conditions.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if there's any comparison here, but I recently saw, I think it was an editorial on CNN about how during the last administration, one of the CNN reporters, Barbara Starr, who covered the Pentagon, CNN was ordered to turn over all her emails. And in the editorial, and I'm not sure who this person is, he has some connection to CNN, said that he was told that if he, you know, revealed this to anybody, that he would be, I guess, in contempt, or he would be, he was always issued an order by a judge not to talk.
Right.
And I know this is totally different, but it reminded me of what you talked about in terms of the FBI tactics and using the grand jury as a threat to these women and people across the country to talk. And just wondered if you could talk about that whole tactic by the FBI, the grand jury threat.
Well, the purpose of a grand jury is to indict people for a crime. So the evidence is usually presented to a grand jury that either suggests there was or was not a crime, and that particular person was responsible for it. And if that's the case, the grand jury then indicts that person, mm-hmm. who then has to face a trial before a regular jury or a judge. In this case, and in fact since the Nixon administration, they have used the grand jury as a way of forcing people to testify through the what is called use immunity. I don't know if we want to get into the technicalities of that, but basically, it forces people to testify. They have to either testify or go to jail. I mean, so that's their basic choice. And they can ask anything in the grand jury. I mean, they can, and you have to answer. And and in theory, this material, this evidence is, as I say, being used to prepare an indictment. And in the case of the Lexington Six, there was never any question of indicting any of them because none of them had ever done anything. So the only indictment could have been for the two fugitives, but they were already indicted in other jurisdictions. So there was no purpose, in other words, no legitimate purpose to the Lexington grand jury. Later, in the appeals process, they came up with the idea that these Lexington Six had been harboring fugitives, which would be a crime which you could indict them for. But there was no evidence for that, so they couldn't have indicted them on that. So the whole thing fell apart by any rational person could see that, and yet it proceeded. I guess that's the part that's really disheartening, because various judges and appeals courts, even the Supreme Court, tacitly allowed the lower court decisions to stand. So So that's disheartening because it was such a blatant injustice, and to see that nothing was done about it, you know.
And you say this led to a national resistance against this grand jury threat by the FBI.
That's right. Well, there were two national organizations, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild, along with the New York Grand Jury Project, which were motivated really by the Lexington 6 case, mm-hmm. Got organized and began a national grand jury resistance movement. And so a number of these subsequent cases were able to access information that was provided by these groups. And they also provided them with lawyers and with tactics that had been developed through the various cases. And so that throughout the country, really, there were a number of these cases following the Lexington 6 case. And it was quite a amazing job of political organizing, really, that when you consider, again, that there was no internet, phones were tapped. I mean, the means of communication were limited, and yet the word spread, and a lot of these communities were prompted not to cooperate, and so so the resistance grew to the point where, as I say, it was really a national movement of resistance to these kind of intrusive tactics by the FBI.
Which took courage, I would think, on the part of these people across the country.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, as I cite in the book, there are a number of them that took very courageous stands, and they ended up in prison. I mean, they spent several months in prison. I mean, it wasn't, just a frivolous statement. I mean, they paid the consequences, paid the price. Some of them, terrible. One woman was pregnant. I mean, they still, wrote it out and stayed the course in prison. So, so it was a lot of examples of spirited and courageous resistance at that time.
I think a good place to end is if you could talk a little bit about how you believe this compares, as you say in the book, to the Stonewall Rebellion in New York City, the famous Stonewall Rebellion.
Oh, well, I think the motivation was somewhat similar of resistance against this intrusive, in the case of Stonewall police, in the case of the Lexington 6, the FBI, intrusion into their community and destroying their community, and the sense of outrage and indignation, and just being fed up with it, I think was similar in both cases. Of course, in New York, it was largely a gay bar that was the site of the resistance, a lot of sort of street fighting that did not happen, of course, in the Lexington case. And the Stonewall case got much more publicity. So the Lexington case was a bit more subdued, and yet the same motivation, I think, the same spirit of resistance, just being fed up with being treated trashily was the same in the two cases.
Yeah. How it led to something spreading nationwide.
What was that?
How it led to this resistance nationwide.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And of course, not just in the gay and lesbian communities, but in a number of other minority communities.
Josephine, this is just, I really appreciated your book. As I read it, I thought, why hasn't this been made into a movie yet? Because it seems like it's such an important story that needs to be told for people that haven't heard it before. So I hope that happens down the line.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your interest and enthusiasm about the book and the case.
Yeah. And to our listeners, if you are interested in reading The Lexington Six, you can click on the highlighted title of the book in the description included with this podcast. You can also go directly to the University Press of Massachusetts website. And join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.